This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. To get a sense of the mood in Washington today, get a load of the normally avuncular, smiling Congressman John Larson on the floor of the House addressing his Republican colleagues who shut the government down in an attempt to defund Obamacare.
Do you stand with your country? Do you stand for your country? Or do you want to take it down this evening? Stand up for your country. Stand up for America. Stand with us this evening and keep this government going in the name of fairness.
Wow. In fairness, there's plenty of blame to go around in Washington as we head toward the next cliff, a possible default on government debt. What does the public think of all this? Well, Congress's already miserable approval rating is down near single digits and heading toward the same number as the unemployment rate. A new Quinnipiac poll shows that Americans overwhelmingly disapprove of the GOP tactic to shut down the government to force changes to Obamacare, but they're split on whether the law itself is any good. Now, don't tell that to Kevin Counihan, the CEO of Access Health CT, the new healthcare exchange that just opened yesterday.
We're just extremely excited at the office, and to be honest with you, John, I'm looking forward to getting out of here and celebrating.
Now, don't pop the bubbly just yet. On our show yesterday, he announced that the exchange had signed up its first member and that glitches and slowdowns are to be expected. But in Connecticut, as in the rest of the states, computer problems and high volumes slowed things way down. By 4 o'clock yesterday, the exchange had taken nearly 2,000 calls and signed up 83 people. At that rate, Connecticut's 340,000 uninsured will get health care by Christmas 2024. Today, Where We Live, it's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. We'll tackle those stories along with the latest on Metro North, slowed down by a power problem that might plague commuters for quite a while. And we'll even consider what's next for UConn football. Our guests today are Colin McEnroe, as always, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Welcome back, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Christine Stewart is here, the editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. Hi there, Christine.
Hi, John.
And Keith Faniff, his budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror.
Go Pirates.
Oh, well, I have to say, and we're going to start there, actually. We're on CTN today as well. Colin, I'm just going to take a moment and talk with you about something. You said something to me on the way into the newsroom that I think is quite true. Perhaps the Pittsburgh Pirates are the only thing to feel good about in America today. It could very well be the case.
As long as you're not from Cincinnati, anyway, the Pittsburgh Pirates are. It really is. It seems like a very dark time, but we're vicariously basking in the glow of your joy about your Pittsburgh Pirates.
We'll see how long that lasts as they head into a showdown with the St. Louis Cardinals on Thursday. We will be talking football a little bit later on, but let's talk first about the federal government shutdown. Before I get into some details from Keith and Christine about what we might actually see here in Connecticut, what does all this mean to you, Colin? I mean, we see the numbers, poll numbers around this sort of thing. I don't know what they really mean. Yes, we don't like Congress. Yes, we don't think that they're doing their job very well. What does all this say to you?
Well, you know, even just listening to John Larson, and he's sort of gotten bad reviews in the political press about his about the rant that we just played there. I actually don't think he's going to go down in history as the guy who yelled about the wrong thing. I think a lot of people feel like yelling right now. My only real problem was what he was yelling about. And I think, you know, really – the real problem here is things like the FDA and the EPA aren't functioning. And then the real problem is stuff like WIC and Head Start, programs that really do provide direct assistance to people across the country. You know, there are kids who depend on Head Start for the only nutritious meal they're going to get all day. There was a very compelling piece on All Things Considered last night about this Head Start center in Alabama, where this woman really kind of spelled it out, you know, what it really means when these things close. I'd simply add also at the National Institutes of Health Clinical Center, they are now turning people away for clinical trials that they were eligible for. That includes 30 children, most of them cancer patients. If I were John Larson, I'd be yelling about that stuff.
Yeah, when you're talking about fairness, I'm not exactly sure what that means. The yelling is right, but it seems as though there are real stories to tell as you're talking about, Colin.
Yeah, I mean, John's old school. There might have even been a beverage involved in his rage. But, I mean, you know, he's got the right tone. The question is he Howard Beale or is he Howard Dean? I think a lot of people are really appalled by this, really appalled by this. And I think as they know more about it, they'll be even more appalled.
And what Colin was talking about there is periodically they hand out Red Bull on
right.
the floor of the House. Christine, well, what do you think this all means? I mean, we're talking about stories from Alabama and around the rest of the country. What do you think this is going to mean in Connecticut?
You know, in Connecticut, it's going to mean probably a little bit more if you work in the defense industry than it is in any other sector. I mean, you're still going to be able to get your passport if you need a passport. So some of those just regular functions are still going to be happening. But, you know, if you're a civilian and you work at Sikorsky, you may get, you know, furloughed until the government starts funding these programs again.
Keith, I know that there's a lot of worries from people who watch the economy of the state that this is somehow going to even set us further back. Connecticut is lagging on a number of different economic indicators, including our unemployment rate. Does the government shutting down for a while really do anything? And how long might a shutdown have to go until it really starts to hurt us?
If you listen to the community of economists, they're basically saying after about a couple of weeks, the shutdown, that's when the shutdown hits the fan. That's when it starts to have impacts, serious impacts on the economy that ripple out. And I think that the real danger is, at first, it's what Christine mentioned. You got maybe about 9,000 people who may not be getting a paycheck right away, whether they are certain types of federal employees or contractors working for the federal government. They're not buying as much. Maybe that affects business confidence. But when investor confidence gets shaken, whether that comes because we default on our debt or just because the shutdown's gone on too long and Wall Street starts to tumble, that's when Connecticut really pays, because when Wall Street takes a hit, not just the state budget, but the state's economy can plunge quickly. That's always been our case in past recessions.
And that's a really important point here. In a lot of ways, we really rely, Fairfield County specifically, rely on Wall Street. That's what drives the economy. It's why periodically we have these big drops in our overall state revenues, because whenever Wall Street's not making money, we're not collecting as much tax revenue from these folks. You've written about it for years, this volatility. This is another cycle where it seems as though our reliance in Fairfield County and in Connecticut on Wall Street throws us into a very volatile cycle right now.
Yeah, just two numbers that'll tell it all. Last year, people were a little nervous because the state income tax, as far as revenues from withholding people's paychecks, it went down a little less than 1%. The exact same time, the money we got from Wall Street went up by 17%. And that's about 40% of all the income tax revenue. So things can turn on a dime.
Keith, one thing that you've done a great job of reporting about, helping me understand too, is the way that a slowdown in federal funds then hits the state budget, and the state because the state budget obviously pays out a lot of those federal funds. And then the question is, do we have any money we can divert into programs like TANF and things that once again hit these incredibly vulnerable populations who, you know, the stuff that you're talking about is very serious stuff, but there's a little bit more of a cushion there. Most of the people who live on these programs don't have a cushion. They don't have an alternative.
And that is a problem, too, because Connecticut, unlike a lot of other states, has made decisions. There are things that we want to fund that the federal government doesn't. Things that as subtle as, I mean, teen pregnancy prevention. That's something we do entirely on the state's dime. What happens when the economy goes and we start having to make choices about if we contract in certain areas? We've already been kind of trimming back our safety net. That's a little more down the road. One other thing I wanted to just throw out, though, is people are saying, you know, right now it's not going to affect too many services. But there are a lot of services, I think, when this is all done, we'll find slip through the cracks. Discretionary money from Washington. Over half the money Connecticut gets from Washington doesn't go to the state government. Some goes to town government. Some goes to nonprofits, to businesses. About $8 billion a year comes into Connecticut from the federal government. A lot of people will probably be seeing less of that money or none of that money for a while.
If you want to join us, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. Are you mad about any of this? Are you upset about the federal government shutdown? Are you excited about Obamacare coming to Connecticut, which we'll be talking about next? 860-275-7266. You can also email us wherewelive at WNPR.org, or you can tweet us at wherewelive. Of course, yesterday, as the government shutting down, Connecticut and the rest of the states that are taking part right now ramping up their new health care exchanges. You know, just yesterday we had on Kevin Counihan, who's running this new health care exchange. Here's a bit of what he told us about this slow going early on for Access Health CT.
I consider this day one in a 3-year enrollment period. And so I think it has it's sort of a nice metaphor for launching a major social program. But it, frankly, in the big picture, it doesn't have a lot of value.
Yeah, I mean, he's talking about some of the slowdowns that we've had over the course of the first day. Christine, what did we find? What did we hear from Kevin Counihan and his colleagues about day one of Obamacare in Connecticut?
You know, there were going to be some glitches, of course, with the website and technology. Anytime you're talking about technology, you're going to have a glitch. They did actually better than they expected. They got 167 people to sign up, 83 of those onto the three private insurance carriers and 84 onto Medicaid. So the state has decided to expand its Medicaid population. So if you make under 138% of the federal poverty level, you now qualify for Medicaid. So a lot of people who don't have insurance now, who are uninsured coming to the exchange, will possibly be enrolled in Medicaid.
Are we expecting too much on this first day, this first week, this first maybe even year of a program like this, Colin? I mean, obviously, there's an awful lot of buildup, but it's easy to say, well, slowdowns and computer glitches are going to be there. I mean, what do you think?
Well, you know, it is the first day. I think the more important thing is the sort of disjointedness between the perceptions that have been kind of shopped at us by, well, like if you just watch Sean Hannity and people like that all day long, you would just conclude that nobody wants this. Nobody wants this. It's an abomination. Well, the federal site that serves, I think, the 30 states that don't have health exchanges, I think they had 2.8 million visitors yesterday.
That's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people. You know, maybe some of them are just shopping around to see how much they hate it. But I think most of them are just interested to see whether they can get health insurance there. It does indicate, I mean, if there are glitches and if the glitches are due to kind of overloads on servers and stuff like that, the primary message is people are really at least curious about it and in many cases quite eager.
Keith, I guess I'm wondering, have you done any sort of look at what getting all these people health insurance is really going to mean for the state? There's a lot of talk about how a government shutdown might negatively impact our economy. You know, after a little bit of time when we start to get some of these folks signed up, does it start to move us in a good direction to have more people actually getting health care here in the state?
I'm sure there have been. The short answer is I don't know, like a precise, nice. I wish I had a factoid for this one.
Yeah.
But there have been some studies about what it means, but the real impact comes decades down the road. And when you have people, a significant portion, almost all your population, seeing a primary care provider, getting regular checkups, that's when you really start seeing a difference. In terms of anything we can really measure, I think it's going to be quite a ways off. I mean, as you pointed out at the start, at the pace we're signing people up, and I know we've just started.
And we just made a joke about it. But yes, at that pace, yes.
It's a snail's pace. I mean, and the other problem is that this was part of the political trade-off. The Obama administration emphasized that a tax on the wealthy would help pay for this. What they didn't emphasize is that another way we're paying for it is shifting a significant cost burden onto young adults to pay for insurance that, you know, most of them probably won't need. And we're talking about people that are already coming out of college now with significant debt, just have a bachelor's degree. That's why they can't buy homes. There are going to be ripple effects on this for quite a while as people fight over it.
I want to get to a few quick phone calls here. Sarah's calling from New Haven. Hi, Sarah. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. Well, first of all, I do support Obamacare. I'm very excited to go through. I'm already insured, but unfortunately, I'm a federal employee work for U.S. Customs in New Haven, but since we're quote-unquote essential personnel, I'm one of the special few who's going to work and not getting paid. So while there are plenty of people being furloughed and nobody's happy about it, and the frustration in in my office and among the other officers is tangible, the fact that we have to go to work but we're being furloughed, and we don't know when this is going to end. And a lot of us we're living in an age where we live paycheck to paycheck, and it's scary and it's frustrating. And, you know, talk about a direct hit, but I can't even look on the news because I see it. And the fact that the people that are fighting, they're getting paid. Those federal employees are getting paid, but we're taking a hit.
One of the things, Sarah, I wanted to ask you about is there's this question of when is this going to end, but it also seems as though you and other federal workers are a pawn in a game that just keeps being restarted again every few months. It seems as though we're going to hear once again about another government shutdown soon. We've already had cuts due to sequestration. At a certain point, Sarah, it seems as though this is something that could persist for quite some time.
How do you feel
about that?
I'm extremely frustrated, although, you know, it's almost been like not a running joke, but we have, we get mustered every few months about, you know, our funding and the fact that we're broke and there's no money for this or that or to get, basically to put gas in our government vehicle. But this one was almost played off as the rest of them, but it's more real than the other ones, you know? So it's very frustrating to reconvene over something that just can't, you know, is not being resolved. And I don't know what the answer is, but I just know that the frustration is just tangible. And now it's fear because, you know, I live, you know, like many people everywhere, paycheck to paycheck. And so I don't know, you know, I just hope that they get their heads out of it, you know what?
You know? Well, Sarah, hold on for a second. I might want you to talk with our producer, and I really appreciate your phone call. I want to get to Bill, who's calling from Windsor Locks. Hey, Bill, go ahead.
You know what? I would like to see you and what's his name there, the other fellow, the radio guy there, and the Connecticut Mirror people come up with some sort of program or even in writing of Obamacare for Dummies like they do in the college, you know? Because you need to lay out what we pay for what's going to have to pay for the premiums and how much is the deductible, and they need to go deeper as to what is covered, because I've heard all kinds of things out here in the street where certain things are no longer going to be covered. Certain parts of things are not going to be covered, like if you have a colonoscopy, they're not going to cover the anesthesiology, or if they do the little snipping in there. I mean, so what part, is that true? You know, get a question and answer thing going.
Well, and you know what we did? And Bill, first of all, great question. And we had some of that yesterday with Kevin Counihan. We weren't able to get to a whole lot of it, but I will refer you to our website, WNPR.org. We have got a post up there with a few different calculators. One is essentially Obamacare 101. It's a widget that's produced by WNYC. It takes you through those very same questions. The other one is an Obamacare calculator. And what you can do is put in some basic information, some numbers, and find out how much it's going to cost you. And I know there are a lot of other resources out there too, Christine. I mean, there's places for people to find this information.
No, there are definitely places for people to find this information. And the problem is that it's so individual. I mean, it's based on your age. It's based on your specific family situation. You know, on my side, I have some Let's Do Some Obamacare Math, a post about, you know, exactly how you get to the premiums that you would be paying based on your age. And at the bottom of the page, I also have the benefits that are covered under some of these plans, which I don't think that we're getting enough of from the Access Health CT website at the moment.
I know in your site, Ariel Levin-Becker was on our show yesterday. He's been doing a series of reports, Keith, for the Connecticut Mirror about this, answering some of these very same questions.
Sure. Another problem I think that people are having is so much of this is just wrapped up in politics, is that there's so much spin out there. There's not a lot of straight talk. I say without any judgment, people in Connecticut are going to be paying basically the highest rates in the nation. And the question is, even with our cost of living, is it still relatively too high? I think we'll be debating this for a while, going back and forth.
Yeah, I think as people were shopping yesterday on the Connecticut website, many of them were finding that the cost is going to be high. In terms of the caller's other point, first of all, this is going to vary a little bit from plan to plan, but more based on deductibles and stuff like that. In terms of actual coverage, I can't guarantee you that your polyps that get snipped during your colonoscopy are going to be covered or not covered. But the thrust of the Affordable Care Act is to standardize what health insurance is. So it should be less of a crapshoot. You should have a clearer idea of what coverage consists of, and it should be pretty standardized. My guess, and it seems to be more inclusive and ambitious than most healthcare plans that you would encounter on the private market.
And honestly, more transparent in the way you're able to find that information, even at this early stage, Christine, without a whole lot of information out there, it's easier to find than it is through, I don't know, your current health insurance plans website if you wanted to find out what you're covered for.
Oh, yeah. No, definitely. It is more transparent. But I think what people are also forgetting is that there is no public option. So these are three private health insurance companies offering their plans through the exchange. I know that some of the opposition to this talks about socialized medicine. Well, it's, you know, there are federal subsidies, but there is no public option, thanks to Joe Lieberman.
We have to. You're the one who took the dig at Joe Lieberman. Colin's sitting right here. That was nice of you to do. Ken's in Hartford. Ken, quickly, before we take a break, go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Sure. I wonder if the problem isn't just Republican intransigence. It's just the rules of the elections themselves that allow gerrymandering. President Roosevelt, at the height of the New Deal, was frustrated with the Supreme Court, so he threatened to pack the court. Why isn't Obama coming out and saying, we need a national gerrymandering redistricting conference to deal with Congress and its intransigence, because millions more people voted for Democrats than they did Republicans. I'm not a fan of the two-party system, as you know, but geez, I don't think Congress is representative of what's actually happening.
Ken, thank you very much. Quick thought, Colin?
I think President Obama is saying the right thing right now. First of all, I think he has his hands full. I don't think he can have a gerrymandering conference right now. But
he's going to Malaysia, from what I understand.
He's saying the right thing. Look, this thing is a law. It was passed by Congress. It was signed by the president. It then passed muster with the Supreme Court. John Roberts said that it was constitutional. Now this tiny faction of one party in one chamber of Congress is basically saying, and they like to call it a bill sometimes too. It's not a bill. It's a law. And they want to overturn it without following due process.
But you know, that last caller's central premise is right. Why do we have such a polarized Congress? Well, when you gerrymander, you create polarized districts, and the people you have to answer to back home generally have one philosophy, whether it's to the left or the right. You want a more balanced Congress? Stop making secure districts, make them more balanced.
When we come back from our break, we'll talk about last week's major shutdown, Metro North. It's still ongoing. WNYC's Andrea Bernstein joins us to talk about who admitted to likely causing this power outage. You can join us in the Wheelhouse, 860-275-7266. We'll be right back after this break, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today, it's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. Our guests in studio are Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, Christine Stewart, the editor of CTNewsJunkie.com, Keith Vanoff, who's the budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. We'll take your calls in just a moment. Now, we were just talking about the shutdown of the federal government, but now we're moving on to a different kind of shutdown. Last week, a power outage caused a major outage on the Metro North New Haven line. Here's Governor Daniel Malloy speaking to reporters last Wednesday.
Something happened to the line that was otherwise sufficient or thought to be sufficient to feed the system, and it's gone down. All of that has happened in New York State, not in Connecticut.
Not in Connecticut, in New York State. Now, 1 week later, Metro North's operating at about 65% capacity. Could be another week before the problem is completely fixed. On top of it all, the Connecticut Post is reporting another power outage yesterday, not related to last week's. Joining us by phone is Andrea Bernstein, who's Metro editor for WNYC News. She covers transportation issues quite frequently. She's spoken to us about Metro North on the program before. Andrea, welcome back to Where We Live.
Thanks so much.
So what do we know about what happened in New York State, as the governor of Connecticut will continually remind us? New York State, not Connecticut. What happened?
Well, it's an interconnected ecosystem. What we know is that Con Ed, according to its own, what it's describing as a preliminary review, indicates that the reason that this giant feeder cable broke is because of work related to maintenance. So just to backtrack, what was going on with the power supply to the New Haven line was that there were two feeder cables. Metro North had taken one of them out for maintenance, but in so doing, the workers tripped the remaining one, and that's why the power was lost. Now, what's not clear is why Con Ed didn't have a Plan C, considering that this is the nation's number one commuter rail line that has been so severely affected by this loss of electricity.
It's been severely affected this time. Of course, we had the crash near Bridgeport last year on Metro North. It seems as though each summertime we have problems with outages when power lines sag. Each wintertime we have outages. Do you think that this finally is starting to shake people up in taking a closer look at MTA, some of the practices and some of the ways in which the associated organizations like Con Ed are actually working to get people to work on time? Is anything going to be done, Andrea?
Well, I think that there's a couple of different threads that are important to unravel here. One is that there has, as lots of commuters know, been a problem with the rail cars themselves. And this was because of a decades-long disinvestment by Connecticut government in the rail line. And we have sort of put together all the numbers, and it looks like, indeed, it wasn't because the MTA did anything differently. It was because the government of Connecticut withdrew some of its funding, and scheduled maintenance, scheduled replacement of rail cars didn't happen on schedule. And after decades of disinvesting in infrastructure, that is what you see. So that is a separate issue from this power line thing, even though obviously to the passengers and customers it feels like the same. It just feels like a messed up commute. But the broader issue of how much investment is there is in infrastructure is something that's probably worth thinking about, and I think affects both the electric grid and the transit authority. You know, people don't really like putting money into things that are very hard to see, like feeder cables, electric grids, and even things like railroad tracks, until they stop working.
Yeah,
and then everybody gets mad.
Much like the government shutdown, it seems as though there's lots of blame to go around, and it's not just New York or Connecticut. I know Keith Faniff has a question.
Andrea, can you tell me, because I'm curious about this. I got that they took down one feeder line for maintenance and another line subsequently failed. Have they determined the why? Because it sounds like the only reason you'd shut down one line is you assume the remaining line can handle the capacity. Do they know, other than the fact that they never had a plan C, what actually caused that to glitch up?
What we know now is that there is this process when you have, and I just learned this week, but when you have a high-voltage feeder cable, it's housed in an oil-filled pipe. And you go through a process of basically freezing the oil to handle the electric line during maintenance. But something went wrong during this because, Con Ed says, the ground was frozen, and this somehow caused the feeder to fail. Now, that's all we know now. We don't know any further details. They've indicated this is a preliminary review. But one of the questions we're asking is, and we sort of have been joking, is this a way to run a railroad? Is why were, the commutes of tens of thousands of people dependent on this one feeder? That seems a very vulnerable situation to put everyone in.
I know, Christine, you and others have been talking with the governor, who's been very upset about this. What are we hearing about things getting back to normal and maybe what Connecticut officials are doing about it?
Well, I mean, he's talking about, adding some redundancy beyond what they currently have to the line. But this is going to, take some investment from the state. So things have gotten a little bit better as far as times go this week. I think they're up to like 65% capacity. But, investment has been lagging.
It has, Colin?
Yeah, I want to, first of all, second Andrea's emotion about the cars themselves. Last weekend, I was riding the Hudson River line on the same system from Yonkers into Grand Central, and it was like I was in the future. It felt like the Jetsons compared to what we have here in Connecticut. But I also want to quickly say, the other part of this to look at is the vulnerability of the our electrical grid in general. In a month from now, something called the North American Electric Reliability Corporation is going to stage a test of Con Ed and 199 other utilities. What would happen in a much larger cascading grid collapse? This happened in India last year, where 600 million people lost power. It can happen as a result of a cyber attack. And if you're seeing the paralysis caused by one set of cables on a rail line and how long it's taking to restore full power, imagine a cascading power grid collapse where, in fact, either because of solar flares or cyber attacks or something like that, we lost a lot of power in a lot of places and couldn't get it back up. And it actually is a somewhat scary thing. Our grid is less fragile than India's, but we don't know how much less fragile than India's. And stuff like that, this is like a cough, that what we're seeing right now, that could turn into the flu.
Andrea, what Colin said just scared the hell out of me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in general, the United States infrastructure is probably in better shape than India's. But I think that, sort of larger questions of how much money people want to spend on things. And, this is the one of the things that the president has been pushing for it feels like years now. I think, as a matter of fact, it has been years, is a $50 billion investment in U.S. infrastructure. And this is something that tends to go nowhere. And at various points in history, I have asked voters about this. Do you want to invest in things like roads and bridges and rails? And the response that always comes back is that, yes, I think those things should be invested in, but I don't feel like paying for it. And I think that there is a moment of reckoning that is going to arrive soon as we see more and more things like this with essential infrastructure failing. I mean, we saw it during Sandy. During Sandy, the reason that the subways were out in Lower Manhattan for 4 days wasn't because of the subways. It was because of the electrical failure, which meant that water could not be pumped out of the subway lines, and the subway lines could not run.
Andrea Bernstein is Metro Editor for WNYC News. She helps us cover transportation issues and our interstate issues that we periodically have. Thank you so much for joining us once again. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Now, Keith Vanoff, Andrea was just talking about public investment in infrastructure. This is something we talk about an awful lot, and we're going to get to bonding for a quick moment. The story that we keep talking about back and forth, Keith, is this idea that the state, you know, does all this bonding, but they don't actually spend the money. The Fred Carstensons of the world, the economists say, if we did bond for more infrastructure improvements, it would help keep us from doing things like what just happened. Our stuff breaks. And it would also put people to work. It would create a whole bunch of jobs. But now bonding is sort of back in the news this past week, because when Governor Malloy goes with the bond commission, we're bonding for other sorts of things like Bass Pro Shops at Steel Point in Bridgeport. Maybe you can help us connect the dots a little bit. When you're talking about bonding, you seem to be saying a little bit more borrowing might be good for the economy. A lot of Republicans are saying borrowing like this, it ain't so good for the economy.
The Republicans on this one, I have to say, are all over the place. And I do think politics is coming in. They can't decide what message they think is scarier. Some people think bonding's too wonky, so let's go for the simple message. We're approving too much bonding. We're spending like crazy. And then you have some other Republicans, like Representative Vin Candelora, that are focusing on what I think is the larger problem that UConn focused on, which is, no, we're approving all this bonding on paper, but we're not actually carrying it out. We're not actually going to Wall Street, borrowing the money, and spending it. That's the bigger question. What UConn and Fred Carstensen looked at is basically showing, if you played that game when you were a kid and you turned on the hose in the summer and then you kinked it, you know somebody's looking at one end and they can't get any water out, then you unkink it and they get splashed in the face. Fred wants us to unkink our bonding hose. We have approved $6 billion worth of bonding that we haven't gone out and get yet. And quite frankly, when Governor Malloy talks about it, he's dancing around it carefully. He's saying, well, you know, sometimes when you approve projects, the interest rates aren't right. You don't bond. That's true. Sometimes you have to do the legal approval of the bonding years before you're ready to spend the money. That's true. There's always some overlap. Fred Carstensen didn't say, oh, my God, there's an overlap. He's saying, do we know this backlog has doubled from $3 to $6 billion in 2 years? That's the trend. That's the problem. And to give you some perspective on what $6 billion means, up until this year, the bond commission was approving about $1.5 billion a year. We have the equivalent of 4 years worth of bonding. We have permission slips to borrow that we still haven't done. It's the trend that's the issue, and that, quite frankly, the governor hasn't addressed yet.
The line, Fred wants us to unkink our bonding hose, is one of the best things I think Keith has said on the program recently.
That was H-O-S-E. I just want to emphasize that for anybody
yes,
who was confused.
Yes, it was.
But before we move on, Christine, but one quick political thing about this that has come up is Governor Malloy has said, essentially, he wants to make sure that at Steel Point, this Bass Pro Shops actually gets off and running. And this was a plan that has been on the books for years and years and years, as he made a point to say, well before he became governor, other governors have wanted to develop there. Mm-hmm. Now this Bass Pro Shops is going in, but some people are a little bit concerned that the governor, who doesn't want to have guns in the state and or sometimes gun jobs in the state, wants to put a gun store at Bridgeport Steel Point.
Well, look, we already have Cabela's in East Hartford. You know, they also sell guns. The Bass Pro Shop isn't going to be selling guns that aren't allowed to be sold in the state of Connecticut. And actually, the bonds that they are using for the Bass Pro Shops in Bridgeport are they're bonds that are going to be paid off with the sales tax revenue from the sales. So these are not general obligation bonds that we're talking about in general when Fred says release the bonding money.
Do you think that bonding our way out of this hole to create jobs, Colin, is something that works for the Malloy administration as a tactic? Because it does present some questions, and it's certainly something that people can raise on the campaign trail, given the fact that we do have quite a bit of bonding debt already.
Yeah, I'm in danger of saying something really stupid right now because I don't know anywhere near as much about this as Keith does or Christine. But just even reading the coverage that, that they've done, one of the questions that I have, when Fred, I thought Fred Carstensen's report last week made a certain amount of sense. But I think also he's really talking about what we think of more as standard capital infrastructure improvements.
Yes.
We get some money. We build a high-speed rail line from New Haven to Hartford, and then you and I can ride on the trains.
Or even the Yonkers line or whatever.
Or anything. You know, whereas when we're talking about bonding to basically create commercial opportunities, build some of the infrastructure that commercial developers need, but also just really kind of create opportunities in the private sector. This is, to me anyway, it's a slightly different use of bonding. We can go back to Adrian's Landing, which is obviously built with tremendous infusions of public monies. The notion being not that it would ever be profitable itself, but that it would create other kinds of commercial opportunities. It seems to me with Steel Point, which, by the way, are only now just beginning to happen, but with Steel Point, we're even a little closer to basically being private developers. As I say, that may be a stupid observation, but it seems to be a little bit different from what Fred's talking about, putting people to work, you know, building train lines.
My God, was that stupid. No.
I was worried about that.
I want to try something, and I promise I'm not going back to the garden hose. Yeah. Fred didn't call for some new philosophy. Mm-hmm. He's basically saying we have to actually carry out what we've started. We have an IOU list to Connecticut of projects that we say, well, we're going to approve, we're going to do this project, and then in small print underneath it, in 2018.
It's essentially pointing out something that people aren't really paying attention to. We see that things get bonded, but we don't ever pay attention to whether or not the money gets spent. I just want to quickly, because we got to take a break. Jeff's in New Haven. One last call on sort of how we're feeling today. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Hi, I just had a comment on this Republican shutdown of the government and also furloughing government employees. I really don't agree with it. I think it's really despicable that we do that. There's people being furloughed and made to go to work on top of it. And yet we're a government that feels we have to police the world to make sure other governments are treating their people properly. But most importantly, this whole showdown over Obamacare, you know, and I'm sorry, I came in on the end of whoever said this, but I heard somebody say, you know, this is a law now. Yeah, it was a bill at one point, and I was never so embarrassed to be an American until I heard Nancy Pelosi utter the words, we have to pass this bill to read it. And nobody thinks about that. Had that been passed properly, maybe everybody would be a lot more content with what was in the bill.
Jeff, thank you very much for your phone call. Now, when we come back, we're going to switch gears, we're going to talk a little bit about Breaking Bad, but we won't give away any spoilers. Colin McEnroe in Salon this week, talking just a little bit about why we need to punish people like Walter White. We're also going to talk about whether or not the coach of UConn needed to be punished for the team's miserable start. We'll take some of your calls at 860-275-7266 here in the Wheelhouse on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, there's been a lot of international news recently. The Syrian civil war, discussions with Iran, U.S.-Russia relations, just to name a few. But the decades-long conflict between Israel and the Palestinians continues in the minds of many. And we'll talk with several people whose lives have been directly affected by this conflict. They're in Connecticut as combatants for peace. That's our conversation tomorrow on Where We Live. Today, it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable here on Where We Live.
Do you know how much I make a year? I mean, even if I told you, you wouldn't believe it. Do you know what would happen if I suddenly decided to stop going into work? A business big enough that it could be listed on the NASDAQ goes belly up. Disappears. It ceases to exist without me. No, you clearly don't know who you're talking to, so let me clue you in. I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot, and you think that of me? No, I am the one who knocks.
It's Bryan Cranston as Walter White on the AMC show Breaking Bad.
I thought that was Jamie Dimon, actually. Yeah.
Now, I haven't seen the end of the last season, which wrapped up over the weekend, so no spoilers here. I know Christine's at least a season behind. But Colin, you wrote about Walter White and Jamie Dimon and our need to punish the bad guy in Salon this week. Tell us the story.
Well, yeah, actually, Salon approached me about doing something about this, and my immediate reaction was, yeah, we use television to process our lives a lot. You know, I mean, that's why there are so many TV shows about people's workplaces and their friends and stuff like that. Star Trek was just one big, huge work, you know, series about a very diverse workplace, how to function in it. But we use television for things that we can't get in other ways. We don't see a direct connection between crime and punishment in a lot of sectors, particularly the financial sector these days. Just watching what's happening right now with J.P. Morgan Chase, where, in fact, they are just basically paying fines again and again. They are the equivalent of a recidivist criminal. I mean, again and again and again, they're called to account for these misdeeds, for lies, for misrepresentations. And all they do is just sort of dole out more money, but not in a way that ultimately cripples them. It's actually a pretty profitable way for them to function. Nobody ever gets punished, and certainly the people who crashed your 401ks in 2008, they are not, no matter what they did, you know, very, very few of them, certainly no CEO is ever going to be punished. So, yeah, one of my suggestions was that people watch something like Breaking Bad because they want to see somebody who did something really bad, somebody who was a monster, actually pay for it.
Well, and, you know, this idea of prosecuting the people who crashed our 401k, it's a very interesting idea, and one that, you know, the Occupy Wall Street movement obviously centered itself around. Paying fines periodically in the minds of many just doesn't do it. But, Colin, I have to say, the mood in America somehow with a government shutdown, we've once again directed our anger at Washington and a Congress that doesn't get anything done. We don't seem to really be paying attention to anything that Wall Street's doing.
Yeah, and I think even beyond that, I mean, you're absolutely right about that. I mean, certainly Congress's approval rating right now is a shoe size. But some of it's the financial press, too. I mean, if you look at how CNBC covers some of these people, I mean, they'll even have dialogues on the air very occasionally about what's the right level of punishment for something like J.P. Morgan Chase. But mainly what you see is this exaltation for what a high-functioning bank it is. You know, it's got $2.4 million in assets and $2.4 trillion in assets, $2.2 billion in liabilities. You know, that's a really high functioning bank. And so Maria Bartiromo tends to get really excited about that. The fact that they are in other ways this kind of marauding, you know, quasi-criminal presence on our landscape doesn't seem to bother even CNBC.
Now, and the last thing here is, you know, that clip that we played from the character Walter White, it kind of comes off like the AIG CEO talking about how people yelling about bonuses for executives that bailed out banks was just as bad and just as wrong as the lynchings decades ago in the Deep South. There seems to be this kind of arch tone deafness about the entire thing that somehow or other I am so incredibly special. Don't you understand my brilliance here and the need that we all have for the work that I do?
Yeah, actually, a few years ago, when a conversation was going on about whether or not some of the bailout money should go to beleaguered homeowners instead of to the banks themselves, the number two guy at Berkshire Hathaway, Charlie Munger, said, you know, the people facing those kinds of hardships should just get used to the fact they're not going to get help. He said, suck it up and cope, buddy. Suck it up and cope. They are so tone deaf, so unaware, and so unaware of how offended we are by the bonuses, yeah.
We're going to get to one last thing. As we're talking about, you know, potentially people falling for something that's not going particularly well, we want to talk a little bit about UConn football. They started the season 0-4. On Monday, UConn Athletic Director Ward Manuel announced that Huskies football coach Paul Pasqualoni was being replaced.
The timing of change is never perfect, but change was necessary.
Change was indeed necessary. Let's talk to Paul Meyerberg, who covers college football for USA Today Sports. Paul, welcome to Where We Live.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So look, it seemed like nobody in Connecticut was surprised by this news. Probably nobody in the college football world was surprised by this news. But what did it all mean to you that UConn fired its football coach?
Yeah, no one was surprised. I think the only surprise is that it happened so early, because it is the earliest four games into a year that a coach has been fired in season during this BCS era, which began in 1998. So the speed with which it happened, bit of a surprise, but the speed with which UConn kind of tumbled from the graces of the BCS and the national conversation was equally rapid. So it was just a matter of time. that it happened in September was really the only surprise.
I think the thing that I want to get to with you in these last couple of minutes that we have on the show is this is not a football program like USC, where if you don't win, you lose your job because there's an expectation of winning. It seems as though Paul Pasqualoni and this start to UConn is part of a larger problem with the university. Maybe you can, from a national perspective, just lay out for us, what does UConn really mean in the universe of college football? Are we really at all a big-time program?
No, not at all. I mean, I shouldn't say not at all, but no. I would not put UConn in the same class as any big-time program, I think. The program has certainly taken a hit. If you think about its rating, I mean, it's not an A-plus rating anymore. I think you're looking at a B rating because of several factors. One is that when conference realignment occurred, UConn was the one, in the game of musical chairs, was left standing. They got no ACC, no Big Ten, so they're still stuck in this American Athletic Conference, which is going to be a terrible league. It's a bad league now. It'll be awful next year when Louisville goes to the ACC. It's not a big-time football program. It's not going to hire a big-time coach. So in a sense, Ward Manuel's job, 10 times more difficult than the job and the task Pat Hayden is facing at USC, because Pat Hayden can open up his Rolodex, make 5 calls. He can be done in an afternoon. Ward Manuel's going to have to do his homework and bring in the sort of guy who's going to win against the odds, because recruiting is not great. It's hard to bring in great assistants because the competition is weak. There's no great, hill to climb, because even if you go 11-1, you're still playing in the, Royal Purple Las Vegas Bowl. It's a tough job, not a big-time job. So if anyone believes that at some point there's going to be Nick Saban and there's going to be a big-time college coach who's going to come to UConn, I think no. A small-time coach is going to come to UConn and make himself big-time, because that's the only option really Ward Manuel has.
Colin?
You don't have to sugarcoat this for us. I mean, just tell us the way it really is, all right?
I think UConn in 2009 or 2008 was a significantly better job than it is today, and that's partly because of what Randy Edsall created, but also the dynamics of college football were significantly different 5-6 years ago, especially where UConn's place was in the pecking order. Now, UConn's no better than SMU. You could say SMU's a better job because it's in Dallas, Texas. UConn is on the same level to me as, I think it's below a Pittsburgh. It's obviously below a Maryland. I think it's a very regional program that probably needs a steady hand and almost a genius at this point to turn UConn, lift them back into the top 25 or even the top 40.
Now,
that was a dose of reality.
Oh, yeah, don't go throwing Pittsburgh into all this. Yeah. I'm wearing a Pirates hat right now, Paul. Go ahead quickly, Colin.
I just want to quickly sort of add one little subplot, and people may remember that a man named Robert Burton Sr., a very, very big contributor to the UConn football program, was outraged when Pasqualoni was hired. He felt with $7 million in the game himself, he should have some say over who the football coach was, and he didn't like Pasqualoni. His son had played for Pasqualoni. Burton obviously did sort of take the time to say, I told you so earlier this week. And he said, I hope I have an opportunity to participate in whatever they're going to do with their football program. One thing that may help him get that opportunity is that the president of UConn, Susan Herbst, is now part of the 7-member board of his corporation, Senvio. She's been named to the board of trustees or board of directors there at Senvio. I think there's probably a pretty good chance, given those two things, A, that he was kind of right, and although obnoxious, and B, that he now has the ear of Herbst, who, of course, came aboard post-Pasqualoni, I believe.
And this is something we might want to follow up on another Where We Live wheelhouse. Paul Meyerberg covers college football for USA Today Sports. Thanks so much, Paul.
Thank you for having me. Talk to you soon.
Before we leave, just have a minute left. Colin McEnroe, you weren't able to wear your Red Sox hat today. Obviously, you're a Red Sox fan. Pirates, Red Sox World Series, what do you think?
I would love that. And obviously, the Pirates, I'm not just sucking up to you. The Pirates are one of the really great Cinderella stories in sports this year. So go Pirates.
Christine, I've known you for years. Are you a Red Sox fan or a Yankees fan?
I'm a Cubs fan.
You're a Cubs fan. That's right. You're a Midwesterner.
God. Yes. Yeah.
A long-suffering Cubs fan. So, my goodness.
I empathize with Red Sox fans.
And my 21 years of not being in the playoffs, this means nothing to a Cubs fan. A Cubs fan has been suffering for a much longer time.
Yeah, actually, that guy, the sports writer, was saying, that sounded pretty good to Christine, actually, that description he just...
That's actually somewhat below William and Mary's, but that's great. That sounds great. Keith, how about you? Are you a Red Sox fan or a Yankees
fan? Long-time Red Sox fan.
So next time when you come on, you'll have to wear wear your hat. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Keith Fanoff covers the budget for the Connecticut Mirror. Always good to see you. Christine Stewart is the editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. And Colin McEnroe is the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. What's on your show this afternoon,
well,
Colin?
Well, fittingly, with Breaking Bad, we're going to talk about chemistry and whether chemistry teachers really do have a wild side. We'll have the consultant, the chemistry consultant, to the Breaking Bad program, the person on the set making sure the chemistry was right.
And no spoilers, I hope. Where We Live is produced by Tucker Ives with Betsy Kaplan and Heather Brandon. The senior producer is Katie Tilarsky. Go Bucks. I'm John Dankowski. This is Where We Live.